So we're here again with another podcast from theoneliner.com. I, as always, am Craig. As always, by my side, metaphorically, if not physically, Scott Morris.
Good evening.
And nowhere to be seen or heard, which is frankly about right, because he's an asshole. It's Drew Tavendale. He's not with us here today.
Steady on, sir. Steady on.
He's an asshole.
No.
Drew, I know damn fine when you listen to this, you're going to agree. You're an asshole because you're not here. He jibbed us off tonight. He jibbed us off. He jibbed the listeners off. Technically,
he did what?
Yeah, technically at this point, sorry, I'm using
a custodial sentence.
I'm using vague Merseyside speak here. I forget that the parlance of my locality of the last 8 years is not necessarily that of yours up in Glasgow. He's fobbed the listeners off. No, Drew hasn't fobbed anyone off, folks. He is having ongoing problems with his router, which belongs to Richard Branson, not to name. Not to name any corporations in particular, but his router belongs to Richard Branson.
And unlike the company name, it is fucked.
Yes. It's verily, it is buggered. It is banjaxed. It has ceased to be. It is an ex-router. So Drew won't be joining us tonight because, unfortunately, Semaphore can't carry the bitstream at quite the rate of broadband. I did suggest he light a series of beacons, but apparently they've already started doing that for the Olympics. So yeah, anyway. So can you tell we've only got a couple of films to talk about tonight?
And also, tragically, the beacons summoned help for the city of Gondor.
So, so we've sorted Gondor's problem, but Drew's router's still fucked at this point. Deary me. Yes, we're not killing time here at all. Rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb. Yeah, so anyway, hopefully this is going to be the first in like a burst of, I suppose, shorter podcasts, isn't it, Scott? Because we have left our listeners behind somewhat, and I'm sure plenty of people are peeved at us. We've made a decision to record more frequently, and we have actually written it down so that it might happen. Mm-hmm. We've attempted this before, and it didn't pan out, but we are nothing if not persistent. So we will be recording more frequently, but perhaps with less content, just so we can get stuff out at a better pace to you guys.
The idea being, we'll try and keep it roughly fortnightly, which means that we should keep the number of films down to, you know, 2, 3, 4, which should mean that they'll only take at worst half an hour rather than our 1.5 hour rambles about everything that's been released in the last 3 months, which is,
yes,
probably pleasant for nobody, either recording, listening or editing. So hopefully this works out better.
And very much like one of Khan's crazy mind controlling slugs, you don't want us in your ear for more than half an hour. Come on, unless you like the sensation, in which case maybe you should give us a call.
I'm so creeped out.
In which case, text EAR to 8999. If you don't wish to receive marketing text, end your SMS with no info. Okay, so the first film we're going to discuss tonight is Snow White and the Huntsman, Scott. Not your traditional telling of the fairy tale.
No, not at all. This is not something I had particularly screamed out at me as something that required viewing. While it's one of this season's tentpoles, a fairly good amount of money's been spent on this. The prospect of seeing another telling of Snow White doesn't really scream out as something that's going to be vital to watch. We're all reasonably familiar with Snow White. We've already had one rubbish Snow White film this year already, with the terrible Mirror Mirror. The trailer looked nice. The story itself didn't seem to be doing anything new with the tale, but it actually has. It's substantially different from the usual sugar-coated Disney Snow White that you're probably more familiar with. This goes back more to the kind of original tales. The basics, the broad outline of it is familiar enough that I'm not going to spend too much time going over what's there. Kristen Stewart plays Snow White, same kind of origins. Her mother and father were king and queen of this fairy tale land. They were wise and benevolent rulers. However, when her mother dies, her father becomes sad because of the death of her mother. And this sadness is only lifted by the appearance of Ravenna, played by Charlize Theron, who turns out, of course, to be the evil witch of the story.
Aboo!
Eventually, her stepmother imprisons her. Eventually, the forces of goodness who are still kicking around and the people who are still loyal to the old regime rather than this new Ravenna queen evil person decide to try and break her out, and she's released into the fairy tale kingdom, which is now turning progressively darker under Ravenna's influence. Perhaps the biggest difference in this version of the tale from what the kind of usual more familiar ones would be is that the huntsman, played by Chris Hemsworth, is employed by Ravenna or perhaps more accurately, kind of blackmailed by Ravenna into trying to track down Snow White and bring her back. Snow White, of course, as with other tellings, is the only one who can possibly end this rule of Ravenna. So Chris Hemsworth eventually tracks her down, but soon turns to the good side of the Force and decides to help Snow White rather than harm her. And the two kind of pair up, along with the usual suspects, including the Seven Dwarfs, played variously by people such as Ian McShane, Bob Hoskins, Ray Winston and Nick Frost, and Eddie Marsden and Toby Jones, an all-star cast of dwarfs who'd have thought it. Eventually, they all join up together and try and throw out the Wicked Witch at the end, which is, of course, the usual ending. I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying that Snow White, in this instance, wins. I hadn't really expected anything at all of it going in. Didn't really care about it one way or the other, to be honest with you. So I was pleasantly surprised to find this is actually quite enjoyable. First off, you can't really go too far on a tale like this without addressing the visuals of it. It's obviously a hell of a lot of money spent on the visual aspects of it, and it all shows up on the screen. It does look stunning frequently. It is one of the nicest looking films I've seen in this CG realm. The story's familiar enough. Well, it's going back to a darker themes through it. It's somewhat more adult, but not much more than the usual Brothers Grimm tales. I mean, they've always had fairly dark and undercurrents of realistic nastiness to them, and this is no different. For example, I mean, a Disney film obviously doesn't have the Evil Queen, you're draining the youth out of young girls to sort of supplement her own beauty and give her, extend her life. That didn't quite turn up on the Disney version, but it does here.
And likewise, in this version, I'm guessing at no point do birds come in to help her tidy the house.
They don't, no.
Boo.
There is actually a bird. There's some nod to it. The bird kind of does give her a hints that someone's come to kind of rescue her and ways to escape and such like that. Actually, no, that's more like she escapes on her own back, actually. She's not actually rescued, she has escaped. That's perhaps the one biggest change in this, is that Snow White is no longer a damsel in distress. She's very happy to be a protagonist in her own right. And while the huntsman, Chris Hemsworth, may do a lot of the kind of grunting and shouting at things, Snow White's no wallflower herself. She's happy enough to get in there and mix it with the best of them, which is unusual for a fairy tale princess, and arguably a bit less gendered than anything else. So, one for the feminists, perhaps. Kirsten Stewart is someone who I'm rapidly going to have to accept has actually been okay. By no means the best actress I've ever seen. I think the fact that the first time I saw her was in, I believe,
Panic Room.
Was she in Panic? Oh, of course she will.
Found out recently, yeah, she played the daughter in Panic Room.
Yeah, that's
which
true.
I now think, yeah, that's right.
And what else? Actually, now I come to think of it, I've seen Into the Wild, but I didn't like that film either. And Jumper, but I didn't like that film either, but she's become inextricably linked with Twilight in my head, and that was not a good film to be linked with.
Didn't you enjoy Adventureland?
Yeah. Adventureland's good. So, just because she's so associated with a franchise that I just don't like in the slightest, like, I keep wanting to dislike her, but I'm going to have to accept that I can't back that up with any facts or evidence. She's perfectly reasonable in this role. Chris Hemsworth, who... If you can get over the fact that you're basically watching Thor again, doing much the same role, there's very little difference between this and Thor. But for the sort of role that he needs to do, he's actually shown a bit more charisma than Thor's allowed to. I suspect most of my grumbles with Hemsworth's performance in Thor is more that Thor is not a particularly charismatic character than anything else.
Yeah.
He's okay in this. Yeah, again, the leads are perfectly fine. They're not putting any major revelations in there, but I was surprised by how engaging they were, and their relationship is quite good. They spark off. They've got a decent amount of chemistry to bring the thing through. Charlize Theron's vamping it up wildly as the Evil Queen, and for the most part, that works as well. There's a few points where it just goes a little bit overboard and seems a little bit too silly, even given the context of what's happening. But again, it's an accomplished performance, and the rest of the supporting cast is, you saw the list of the dwarfs there, there's an awful lot of talent supporting this role, and they bring their A game. They've got small parts, but they're all very memorable, which really does help quite a lot. Yeah, I was expecting to not like it going into this, and it turned that around completely, and it's very rare that a film will actually do that. For all I'm complaining about trailers mis-selling films, for the most part you've got a pretty decent idea of what you're going to expect going into it, and I really didn't expect to like Snow White, but I was somewhat arm-twisted into doing it, although it doesn't take a lot of arm-twisting to get me to see any film, regardless of what it is, so that was...
You're going.
It works very well. It works a lot better than I expected it to. It's a very solid entry into the tentpoles of the current season. Not the best film of the year, not going to trouble a top 10 list or anything, but far better than I expected. And yeah, well, of the big budget movies that you could see, you could do far worse than seeing Snow White and Huntsman. Yeah.
That's not interesting. Bad. It's interesting to hear your opinion, because obviously I haven't seen the film, but I'm always, when I hear that phrase, you know, a dark telling of the fairy tale or yeah. dark Rita, I think to myself, oh, really? That's usually a pretty bad sign. But I've been quite intrigued by the richness kind of visually of the film as it's presented in the trailers that I've seen and whatnot. Yeah. I kind of thought, you know, there's something there. And Charlize Theron's always value for money, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like you say, Kristen Stewart's an interesting one. I know she was just recently announced, wasn't it, that she's like the highest paid actress in Hollywood, which when you're this far into an established role in a franchise that's earning your student that much money, you can pretty much name your price. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how that holds once this final Twilight film's been released and her career pans out after that. But I mean, Panic Room aside, because I suppose she's really young there. I hadn't even remembered she was in that until recently.
Yeah,
I think I've only seen her in Into the Wild and about half the film at that, actually, because I haven't watched the whole film.
Don't
blame
you.
Adventureland. Yeah, and Adventureland. She's not like a crazy, charismatic, magnetic presence in anything that I've seen her in, but she's obviously got some sort of acting chops. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what she does. So this film in itself interests me because I think, what can she do, really? This is quite an interesting setting to put her in. I know Twilight's obviously kind of fantasy, but it's not that fairy tale kind of world. Yeah. So. And also the fact that you say, obviously, they've done that thing, haven't they, where it's a bit disingenuous to say whoever in to play the lead roles, because obviously Charlize Theron and to an extent Chris Hemsworth are proven their worth to some degree so far, but to then take like a roster of some of the most amazing talents that Britain has to offer and just give them sort of bit part roles as the dwarves, that's it's that whole thing of Hollywood going, yes, see, we've got the talent. That bizarre thing. Yes, our film has credibility now. It's got Ray Winstone in it. Guess what? As a sweary dwarf. as a comedy sidekick.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what she gets onto with On the Road, where she's the Jack Kerouac wing, which
I am very interested in this. Yes.
A book which I read and thought, it's not unfilmable, obviously. We've decided that's a stupid thing to say, but it's a book that doesn't need to be filmed, perhaps, would be a better way of putting it. And if you did try and do it, what on earth are you going to pick on it? So that would be interesting on a number of levels.
A book which is best left as a book.
Precisely.
It needs no translation into any other media. It fits the form quite well. I don't need it to morph itself into anything different. So, yeah, that's going to be interesting indeed.
I don't need it to be a collection of, tradable cards or anything. Let's just leave it as a book.
Gotta catch 'em all.
Kerouac.
Kerouac. Oh, my God almighty. So, yeah, interesting stuff. Now, the other film we wanted to talk about today was something which intrigued me, not least of all because I'd heard nothing about it until I went to see Prometheus with the missus the other week and saw a stand for it. And surely the design of the foyer stand had me intrigued about this film, and that would be the Simon Pegg starring A Fantastic Fear of Everything. It looks like it should be slightly off-kilter. Would that be correct?
It's certainly off-kilter. Unfortunately, not in a good way. Yeah, but like yourself, I'd seen and heard almost nothing of this until I saw that first trailer, and it does look quite interesting. It's got a unique, or at least if not unique, very distinctive visual style, and I'm normally a fan of Simon Pegg's work. He's got a reasonable quality radar. He doesn't pick too many absolute duffers, even when he's just pulling these off because, it's a star vehicle for him, and, why not do it while you still can? But even his poorer efforts haven't been terrible, like the Run Fat Boy Run, things like that. They're by no means classics, but they're not bad films.
No.
This probably just about doesn't qualify as a bad film either, but I'm afraid it left me incredibly cold. The film itself, Pegg plays Jack. He was a renowned author of children's books, very popular author, but that was not something he wanted to do in his life, so he went back to his original idea of researching Victorian serial killers with the idea of turning them into a book. Unfortunately, Jack's mental. He has
spanner in the works.
Bit of a spanner, yes. He paranoid and neurotic. A great many things become a source of terrible fear to him. And so researching into a grisly world of murder doesn't do wonders for his psyche.
And it becomes, seems like a decidedly stupid move.
It was not the best thing. He should have done a research into pills or something fluffier and cuddlier. So he becomes terribly, terribly afraid that he's going to be murdered by essentially anything and everything, including his own shadow. Much of the first hour or so is kind of confined to Peg in his apartment, basically just jumping at shadows. There's an awful lot of hay tried to be made of this, and having him go running about explaining why he's so afraid of everything, and while he kind of realises it's irrational, he can't help it, and he's terrified of this, he's terrified of the others, he's terrified of the geysers coming round asking for charity money, these kind of things. He's eventually forced to kind of leave the flat to meet a prospective sponsor of his novel, which is on the verge of having the research funding pulled away from it. So it turns into something of a comedy of errors of him trying to prepare for this by doing things like, he's washed his clothes, but he needs to dry them, and he has an incredible fear of laundrettes, so he can't take his clothes to a laundrette to dry them. Instead, he has to put them in the oven. And can you guess what happens? They go on fire.
No one saw that coming.
It's so strangely structured. It's playing it for laughs at the same time as it's also kind of trying to also be kind of serious and kind of make you jump along with Jack as he kind of leaps at his own shadows. And you're never quite sure whether you're supposed to be feeling sympathetic for the guy or laughing at him. I suspect what they were trying to go for is both, but it kind of winds up being neither. An awful lot of that first hour is him floundering around in a flat, not really making any connection or doing anything of any particular note. That's unfortunate. Peg's charismatic enough. He can almost kind of pull something like this off, but there really is nothing underneath it at all. It is very difficult to get into a mode of either liking or feeling any empathy for Jack. That, more than anything else, kind of undermines everything that it does. There's no hook to it. I couldn't find any particular reason to invest in it, and so while for a lot of the time I was sat here, I didn't dislike it or I didn't like it, I just felt completely indifferent to it and a little bit bored, which is almost as bad a thing you can have in the film. When you just don't care much about what's happening, it really is the worst feeling that a film can engender in me. I would rather it be dreadful, so at least I can sit there and work up a feeling of loathing to it. I wasn't really feeling anything for it. It just kind of drags out and it extends itself, and it just doesn't make for a particularly great viewing experience. I will say the last half hour does pick up the pace somewhat. I can't really go into the details too much, but it only really does that by essentially changing tone completely and introducing new characters, and it's all a bit Deus Ex Machina, but it does make for a better ending, so I'm not going to complain about that too much. Plot-wise, it's just shoehorned in, but it's a more interesting way to end the film, and it does supply far more laughs and far more interest. It's a bit cheap. It does feel like it's just the third act's been taken from a completely different play. But like I say, I'm not going to complain too much about it if I didn't like any of the other two acts from the other film. So feel free to crib the after act from another one.
Interesting stuff. It's one of those where I saw the poster and I immediately thought, that looks like the kind of thing that would appeal to me immensely. And then everything I've heard about it since has persuaded me that going to see it would probably be the worst decision I've ever made, which is a real shame because we have a lot of love for Simon Pegg, haven't we, really? He's an affable chap, he's a likeable presence, and he's someone who would like to see do well, but maybe he's going to be having a word with his agent about this one. I suppose it's one of those films that it's not going to affect his profile at all, is it? Because it's here today, gone tomorrow. It doesn't have a great profile. It's probably in a handful of screens. No one's going to remember it. Most people are never going to have heard of it, so
it's the sort of thing I can see why he's done it, because if the script landed to you and it's essentially a one-man play, there's other characters, especially towards the end, but for the most part, this is just him, and this is a complete vehicle for Simon Pegg to display his wares. And I can see why he would have liked to have done this, but it just hasn't quite worked. It's saying something about it when the most interesting thing about this film is that it was written and at least co-directed by Crispin Mills, who viewers of a certain age may remember as the lead singer of Kula Shaker.
Yeah.
Which is, if nothing else, an interesting change of career. But if that is really the most interesting thing about the film, certainly at least most of the film, you know you're in a bit of trouble.
Like we say, you can see why he's done it. And now that the guy's got Hollywood profile and it's Star Trek 2 and it's this and it's that, it's like, let's do those little personal for the kudos projects in between sort of thing. But I guess this is one. Maybe he's happy with it. even if nobody else is. It's probably not one that's going to have a be underlined on his CV in future, perhaps the best way to describe it. Scott, I believe we might take a slight digression into the world of theatre next.
The other day, I was convinced by my good girlfriend, rather than spend the usual Sunday evening of being in a cinema, which is what I normally do, it's my thing, that's just what I do. Let's be civilised, let's be a supporter of the live arts, let's go to the theatre.
Let's be middle class for the day.
That's something I've always wanted to be middle class. I want to see how these people live.
Did you? I want a horse here.
That's middle class. Wow. I've been shooting low all these years. So basically, rather than going to the cinema, we went to the Tramway Theatre in Glasgow's South Side, where we saw Macbeth, the Scottish play by William Shakespeare. The interesting thing is, you probably see, if you've been in Glasgow, you can't have missed the mugshots of Alan Cumming going around the place advertising this. It is an interesting take on Macbeth. It starts off, as you sit down, you notice that the set looks an awful lot like a hospital, and indeed it's a psychiatric wing of a hospital that we're being looked at, and we see Alan coming with somewhat blood-drenched clothes, not blood-drenched, but bloody clothes, coming in, being stripped of that, and these being bagged up into evidence bags. But of course, because it's theatre, it comes as a big brown paper bag with evidence very, very largely written on it, so the people at the back can see, which looks a bit silly when you're sitting down in front. And what then happens is Alan Cumming does essentially a one-man performance of all of Macbeth. The idea being that rather than it being the usual tale of one man's ambition and murder essentially undoing him and his sanity leading to his downfall, it's that kind of theme taking place inside someone's head.
I was going to say, yes, are we talking multiple personalities here?
Yes. Now, this is at once the most interesting idea about this take on Macbeth, and also its biggest weakness. Now, Alan Cumming is an actor that I don't really like very much, and I don't think he's very good, which is why I was somewhat... I'm not going to say I was dragged to it. I did sign up to this willingly, but I was apprehensive, and I think I was proven right, although a lot of other people seem to enjoy it, but it's not my cup of tea if I'm going to be polite about it. I'm going to be much less polite about it going on. Now, the problem is Alan Cumming, and to be fair, anyone can't really produce the sort of range that they would need to cover everyone, Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, Macduff, everybody. Like, the entire cast, Duncan, Prince, King of Scotland, everyone. Basically everyone with a speaking line. The Three Witches as well. A lot of it's really imaginatively done. Like, there's things like because he's in a hospital ward, there's a couple of security cameras around there, and there's some televisions mounted above the stage. And the three witches, the three weird sisters, are him when he'll go to the centre of the stage and kind of crouch down and kind of lean back over his head and kind of looking at one of these security cameras and talk to that one, that becoming the voice of one weird sister and another one. And lots of it are really quite inventively done. The problem is it just doesn't make any sense, and when you do it this way, it just strips the play of all meaning, and I couldn't quite get behind what it was trying to say. Having a whole play meant for multiple people, instead it just becoming one band manically running around the stage trying to keep your interest, doesn't really make any sense, and it kind of strips all the context and meaning from the piece.
I was going to say, it stops being a morality tale or anything like that, doesn't it? It's just a man ranting to himself. And you can see why, from an actor's point of view, that's a challenge an actor might relish. You might also suggest that any actor who would partake of that could possibly require a certain degree of egotism.
Perhaps. I mean, even without getting to that, in many ways it's an impressive performance. I mean, if nothing else, God, it's a feat of memory, more than anything else, memorising the entire thing, or close to the entire thing. There's hints there at the way it interacts with sort of some, like, a very Spartan number of props, that you can kind of get some insight as to why he may be put in this psychiatric institution in the first place, which is cleverly done, I suppose. I'll grant it that. The problem is I just really didn't care about almost all of it, and a lot of it becomes Alan Cumming just ranting in an empty room.
Something Alan Cumming would be best doing on his own in an empty room.
It becomes the Alan Cumming comedy accent half hour. There's points where he does, was it his, I think it was either his Duncan or maybe it's McDuff, I forget exactly who, but there's one person who sounds a lot like our impressions, are not quite the right term for it, but our interpretation of Ewan McGregor. He uses exactly the same accent for him. At some points, the only differentiation that I could find between two characters is that when he's one of them, he's tossing an apple in the air, and when he's not, he isn't.
And I am apple tosser.
Basically, that's it. I don't think that's what the bard was shooting for. What's this man's defining characteristic? He has an apple and throws it in the air occasionally.
This is again, it's an affectation. It's his thing.
It wasn't for me. An awful lot of people were standing up and applauding at the end of it. I was more or less sat in my hands. I really did not see that this was in any way compelling. I was bored by an awful lot of it. You may as well have just put the Macbeth script through an automated speech synthesis machine, like something on a Mac, and just have it scream at you for an hour and a half. I really didn't see I didn't see the art in this. I didn't see I could see the performance in it, but I didn't like the performance in it, and I didn't like the ideas behind it, and I didn't think it made any real sense. It didn't have any real cohesion to it. I don't think I'm alone in this, and I'm fairly sure this is kind of split audiences, because it is a radical reinterpretation, but it's reinterpreting it to the point where it is no longer the original thing.
And no.
That wasn't really what I paid the money for in the first place.
It's a bridge too far. There's always this notion, and I mean, I've been to see Shakespeare a couple of times, done to differing degrees, most recently in Oxford, the Oxford Creation Theatre's Antony and Cleopatra, which we saw outdoors in an old Roman amphitheatre, which was absolutely fantastic. And about 12 years ago, I had the exact opposite experience at the McRoberts Art Centre in Stirling, going to see Macbeth. and it suffered from very much not to the same extent, but very much that thing which, I guess, when dealing with the bard, theatre companies and these productions tend to want to differentiate themselves by finding a new gimmick. In this case, you know, it's Alan Cumming, it's a one-man thing, it's taking place in a guy's head, which is, like you say, has stripped all meaning and resonance from it. Surely there is ultimately no point to that in and of itself anymore. When I went to see Macbeth, it suffered from the achingly hip thing of being sort of, oh, it's quite contemporary, everybody's wearing contemporary dress, the stage is empty, there's no props on stage. And I've always found it difficult to sit through. I prefer just sort of basic literal adaptations. I don't like a twist. I find if a production of anything Shakespearean is trying too hard, I really struggle with it. And in the case of going to see Macbeth myself at McRobert Art Centre, I fell asleep. And what I hadn't been made aware of before I went in is that in this production, they wouldn't be using swords as props, they would be using guns. Because it's a modern interpretation of Macbeth, see? So it's a modern interpretation, see? So what happened was, at some juncture, Macbeth, and I cannot for the life of me remember which character was on the receiving end of a gunshot, but I awoke, obviously quite startled from my slumber, and let out an audible cry in the middle of the McRobert Art Centre.
Lady Macduff, no!
It took me a long time. It took me until I then saw, a couple of years later, I think, Ian McKellen's film adaptation of Richard III, which I have a deep love for now, and which set the action in World War I, for me to appreciate that actually, if done properly, taking it out of its original context can be quite fruitful. By and large, Alan Cumming on his own in a mental institute is a little bit too much of a gimmick to pique my interest.
It's outreached its grasp, perhaps, something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah. And like you say, I mean, with the best will in the world, because I'm sure he's a lovely, lovely man, I've just never appreciated Alan Cumming as a screen presence. I don't find him charismatic. Like you say, ultimately, I don't find him a good screen actor. Maybe I might go and see this production and feel entirely different towards it than you do, but there's a reason why we're very good friends. That's because we have, well, amongst
mutual
other things,
hatred
we have,
of Alan Cumming.
Yes, we have similar tastes, and we tend to dislike Alan Cumming to a similar degree. It's one of the qualities I've always admired most in you, Scott. I see my own hatred of Alan Cumming in you. I don't want to see Alan Cumming in you.
Oh God!
Your
no.
hatred, the hatred I see of Alan Cumming in you. That's. I just want to phrase that properly. I want to get the correct meter there. We don't want to see Alan Cumming in anyone. Yeah, I immediately find the notion of that play from your description of it entirely off-putting.
Yes, it's repellent. Not really because of Alan Cumming, but I don't think there's anyone that could have done this.
No.
It's just not an idea that on paper you it's can see that concept. It makes sense. You can see that someone might think, this could make a good play, but after they tried it the first time, they really should have just went, well, working, is it?
Like on paper, everyone individually looking at that thing, who's involved in the play, the director's thinking, this is great, I've got that gimmick, no one else has done this with Macbeth before, this is going to be brilliant, how am I going to work this, how can we be inventive here? Your actor, in this case, we use the term loosely, is thinking to himself, this is a tour de force, this is the sort of thing that can make careers, you know, if I knock this out of the park. No one's taken a step back from it and thought, yeah, but it doesn't work. There's no point to that.
Yeah.
This really sounds like it's just for the sake of it, really.
I don't mind people being inventive with this sort of thing, people trying to push limits, but this one, you've just pushed it so far that you kind of realise why there are limits to these things for the most part.
They've raised the bar so high.
Yeah.
I hear Joel Silver's a fan of this.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I believe it's now pretty much finished its run in Scotland, so it's now going off to bother New York. So if you are there...
Is it? Oh, yeah. Well...
Just be warned.
Let's see if it challenges one man, two governors. Hey, listen, if you get the chance, complete offset, if you get the chance, if you're ever in Oxford, anyone, if you're listening to this in Oxford and you haven't been to see Creation Theatre, big plug, very good, very good. Edit that out. Pointless. Just trying to pretend I'm cultured. Bet you weren't expecting a little theatrical digression, eh? Culture and that, eh? Thanks for abiding with us. We will be back hopefully a fortnight from now with another podcast. But until then, I have, as always, been Craig, and Scott.
Was Scott? Goodbye.
Yes. Sorry, I didn't really pay attention to the setup there. Yeah, keep it real. Remember, email us podcast@theoneliner.com and follow us on Twitter @theoneliner. Thanks, guys. Speak to you soon.
Horse hair.